Hi, I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Ed Bennett, OD, former Assistant Dean of Student Services and Alumni Relations at the University of Missouri St. Louis College of Optometry, and current Executive Director of the GP Lens Institute.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Terre Haute, Indiana. That is a city that probably isn't as distinguished and as so many others, but I will say that it was the home of Larry Bird when I was there. It's where Tommy John was born. I remember being at Indiana State University's, they were having some type of function, spring sports function, and a friend of mine brought me into it, and that's when they announced that Larry Bird was coming to Indiana State, and we all thought, that's good. He's one of IU's rejects. He might be okay. So those were three very fun years, and really grew up there, and it was more or less the law when you grew up in Indiana to go to Indiana University, so I followed the law.
What did your parents do?
My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad was a beer distributor. So for 8 years, I worked for him in the summers, ultimately as a salesman and a truck driver. And what I learned from that is that I like the product. Anyone who knows me knows that. But I felt like that just wasn't going to be my passion. And I also felt that I'm not anywhere near the businessman that he was. So what really truly happened is my dad always wanted a doctor in the family. His dad was a dentist. My older brother, I grew up with a really, really phenomenal older brother, and he went into med school. He was unfortunately had a congenital heart defect, and in his junior year of medical school, he died suddenly. And so all that kind of combined ultimately for me to maybe look at some sort of medical profession, which I wasn't really intending to do at all. And everybody said optometry sounded good. So I went into it as the most naive person in the world. And of course, it far exceeded any expectations I had.
So I saw that you had studied, got your degree in psychology as a undergrad. Now, how did you make the jump to optometry?
Because I couldn't get an optometry school. I applied my junior year undergrad. I applied and I got the rejection letter on my birthday. And I don't know what that letter said, but to me it said, you know, dear Ed, happy birthday. You're never going to be an optometrist. So I applied again the next year, but I had to have a major. So I majored in psychology and all my courses my senior year are in psychology. And actually, ultimately, when I was on the faculty at IU, I was encouraged to get a master's, and I went right back and got a master's in educational psychology in the area of interpersonal communication skills. And that was a smart decision. That really helped me out tremendously. But no, so a year later, I'm trying to get an optometry school. Well, now it's the summer, still no word. And finally, a friend of, and they didn't have on-campus interviews then. Finally, the first 2 weeks before school began, I got an interview with the head of admissions, very introverted vision scientist. For 2 hours, he grilled me. And he kind of had this laugh whenever he'd see something that I didn't do well in undergrad, which means he was laughing frequently. And he'd go, you know, I got a C in calculus. And so, you know, my self-esteem was somewhere near the core of the earth by the end of the interview. So he finally goes, well, Ed, what are you going to do? The inference being, since obviously, you're not going to become an optometrist. And I really wasn't. I wasn't going to apply a third time. I just figured that this isn't going to work out. And I said, I don't know, Dr. Everson. All I wanted to do is be an optometrist. And he looked at me and he says, you will be. Somebody dropped out today, and I'm going to recommend that you take their spot. So guess who got a copy of my first book? The funny thing is, years later, when I joined the faculty at IU, we had a conversation, and he told me that he got in trouble with the dean for bumping me ahead of several alternates. So all he did was give me my career.
Why contact lenses?
Good question. So here I am, voted most likely to be a mediocre optometry student. And that's exactly, I didn't want to disappoint anybody. Exactly what I was. And I'm a third year optometry student taking contact lens one course. And believe it or not, the instructor started going through his hard lens design philosophy. Bells went off. That was just an aha moment for me. I just thought, boy, this is outstanding. Well, at the end of the semester, they had just started a contact lens research rotation, externship in their fourth year. And it was under the guidance of Dr. Irvin Borish, who's one of the big names in optometry's history. So I really wanted that externship. Well, my contact lens instructor said, who also happened to be in charge of externships, he goes, well, Ed, you have to be in the top 20% of your class. And he didn't say, and you need a telescope to see those people. But he mentioned that, but he knew how much I love contact lenses. He bumped somebody and put me in there. And I want to tell you, Vernon, that was a tremendous life changer, because that rotation, and I did it at the beginning of my fourth year, I was involved in 5 clinical studies. One of those companies ended up paying me grants that paid for my entire tuition for the year. And I got to look at the first extended wear lenses before they were FDA approved, the first soft lens to correct for astigmatism, the first gas permeable lens, which ultimately turned out to be very, very important to me. And all because, you know, I was given this opportunity. And from that point on, that I was hooked. And that whole year I did research for Dr. Borish and Dr. Soni. And ultimately, that opened the door for a faculty position at IU. I was there for 3 years. And at that time, the dean said that it might be a good idea for me to go away. Please leave. To go away and get some experience. You know, if you really want to be here and be in a higher position, which I did, UMSL had just started their school. And they needed instructors to teach contact lenses. And so I ultimately came here, and that was a good decision as well.
Now, I know you've done some time in a practice setting. Why stay in academia for 40 years?
It's a great question. It's one of those that I counsel students and young practitioners quite often, because I really emphasize for them to go into practice and then later on make that decision. I had actually looked at a couple of practices when I was a fourth-year optometry student. One was a beautiful contact lens practice in Indianapolis. But they would have, as I recall, I think they offered maybe $15,000 or $14,000. If they would have offered $17,000, I would be there today. And it was an older couple. He was the OD. She was the business manager. She was probably the one that was challenging for me, and he looked tired. And sure enough, they didn't sell the practice. He died a few years later, and that, you know, I think that practice went away. But because of that, all of a sudden, I was looking at a situation where I didn't know what to do the next year. And Dr. Soni, Sarita Soni, who I worked under, worked it out for me to have a faculty position at Indiana. When I came to St. Louis, there was a great opportunity to work for a famous ophthalmologist who was very involved in contact lenses. When he was actually doing his ophthalmology residency, it was in Boston, and he spent Saturdays fitting contact lenses in Donald Korb's practice, a gentleman by the name of Jim Gordon. So I probably worked about a decade fitting contact lenses in his practice, and that was very, very good. But the hard part, when you're in academia for a while, it's really hard to switch gears and go half-time or full-time into a practice. And I love teaching. I love students. So it was, you lose something when you're not real involved in clinical practice. But I did the next best thing. One of my study patients when I was at Indiana, I was a fourth-year student at Indiana, was a second-year student who seemed to be really nice. So I ended up marrying her, and she owns a private practice, so okay. I get to live it out through her, I guess.
So what's it like being married to another optometrist?
I think it's great. I always kid people, well, how boring. But she's in a really good situation where she's partners in a private practice, believe it or not, with a good friend of hers from optometry school. And I think for me, it's wonderful because I'm really proud of her. She's the best optometrist I know, but also her specialty isn't contact lenses, but she fits contact lenses. And whenever I can help her, I will. And she does everything. And to me, it's never been boring. I'm very happy I married an optometrist. I'll mention a quick story there, Vernon. When my administrative position really for around 20 years is to be in charge of admissions and student services. And I tell the students at orientation every year, the incoming students, I said, on average, four of you will end up getting married to each other. So I go, you might as well just start looking right now and get it over with and enjoy the next 4 years. But it is. Two couples that come out of every class.
You're the executive director of the Gas Permeable Lens Institute. Why did you get involved with the GPLI?
It's funny. I was at a meeting, I believe it was 1984. Paragon Vision Sciences was having an investigators meeting in Scottsdale. And a friend of mine from St. Louis, Frank Fontana, kind of a legendary contact lens practitioner, was running around the table at dinner talking to people, but he didn't talk to me. And what I found out later is they were setting up an organization that was going to be the Gas Permeable Lens Institute. And he did later come to me to be in charge of workshops. And I think their first executive director was director for a year or two, but then he bought a lab, which means he was that the GPLI is the educational division of the Contact Lens Manufacturers Association, which is all those labs out there that make custom soft and GP lenses. So what happens, I'm in Berkeley at University of California, Berkeley with Dr. Bob Mandel and Carl Moore. And we're filming videos for the GPLI, a whole fluorescein pattern evaluation. And I had Dr. Mandel on a pedestal, so it was a real thrill. So we get done, and Carl Moore, this would have been 1987, Carl Moore was taking me to the airport, and he goes, Ed, how would you like to be executive director of the GPLI? And I said, Carl, I don't think so. I just don't think I'm qualified to do it. And he looked at me and he goes, Ed, you don't understand. If you don't take this position, I'm going to drop you off on the side of the highway. And you're going to have to find a plane to ride to the airport. I guess I'll take it. And that was the greatest professional decision I've ever made. The GPLI, we develop educational resources, meetings, symposia, programs for students, residents, and practitioners. And it's really been just the love of my life. We have this 75-member advisory board that are, in my mind, the best practitioners in the country. They really provide a number of valuable ideas and then help those ideas become reality. We've had a very supportive CLMA board of directors. It's just really been a tremendous amount of fun. And I'm in the position now where I'm cutting back on my day job. I'm just retiring effectively the end of August, but we'll still continue to teach some. But my hope is just to really increase my time with the GPLI and be able to maybe increase the number of programs and resources that we have. But my passion is GP lenses, and what a perfect match when you're put into this position, and what a great blessing it's been for me.
I have read about your being a great storyteller and wearing wigs, and then you mentioned getting the master's degree in the education and communication. So how did the storytelling and wig thing get started? And
I think some of us are just frustrated at when you're in front of a class, and that's where a lot of it comes from, is you don't you don't want to be boring. You want to make it lively. And I what I started doing is many of my lectures, I would pre-record myself dressed up in a wig or an outfit or a costume, sometimes as a male, sometimes as a female. And then I would work it out so that I would indicate to the class, well, I'm going to be talking to Leonardo da Vinci right now. And then he pops up and I'm talking to him. And one of the lectures I love giving is called The Doe Family. And I'm dressed up as a whole bunch of different does, both Jane and John, as I recall, but several of them. And it's the same type of thing. It's a summary lecture that I do that I hope helps the students for boards. And so it covers all types of patients, anywhere from Bitorix to keratoconus to multifocals and all these. And I've got a few members of my family also dressed up as does, but it'd be a situation where I'll introduce a case and they have clickers they use their cell phones actually as an audio response system to all the questions pertaining to each case, but I'll introduce each case with a video and I'll talk to that particular doe. And the funny thing about it is, I mean, yeah, I was Jane Doe and I was some of the other does, but I started this about 10 years ago and I portrayed John Doe as Donald Trump. He was just somebody who fired people. Yeah. So, of course, you know, our dialogue, he fired me as his optometrist. So I didn't think much about it until recently.
Yeah.
But it's fun. You know, it's just a lot of fun to get the students more engaged. And I enjoy dressing up and portraying different people.
Well, do you remember the first time you did it? What was your decision process to go like, hey, how about?
Yeah, I there's a young lady who's one of the great GP fitters of all time, and Sue Conley. And Susan was a fitting optician, and she was one of our original advisory board members for GPLI, and now she's an actress. I mean, she truly has left the eye care field, and she is an actress up in Minneapolis. But so Sue and I decided we were at a big meeting called North Central States in Minneapolis. And I think I was Rose Bengal, but I know we dressed up as characters as part of our lecture to the practitioners, and it worked. So I think that and the other time I think that I really got a kick out of dressing up is the Contact Lens Manufacturers Association. Didn't have a budget for entertainment for their annual meeting. So I got asked to be in charge, to be the entertainment, I guess. And I filmed years ago. I had heard the rumor that I was going to be able to be MC for the American Academy banquet, which sometimes can be a little bit dry. So I couldn't wait. I had three skits and I was all ready, and then I never got asked. So I used one of those at the CLMA, and I interviewed a whole bunch of people, and they had scripts where, you know, saying, well, you know, Ed Bennett gets to MC the CLMA banquet. Boy, isn't that great? And then, of course, all these well-known people in the manufacturing industry one by one would go, well, gee, how desperate did you get? Or did he give $10,000 to the organization? And yeah, you know, I just got roasted. And so I would be up in front with all at the CLMA, and they would just show. I'd say, boy, I'm excited. I understand that they interviewed a lot of people. Let's hear what they have to say. And then one by one, they totally roasted me. But the better one was my good friend Chris Pannell, who's a past CLMA president. And I dressed up as women, getting a makeover. And I can't say how and why it clicked. But we were up there just talking about having a makeover, and people were doing it. We were dressed as females, and everybody started laughing. And by the time we got done, we ran into the crowd, and people were stuffing money down our dark, and we made $800 for optometry giving sight. So that's probably the most memorable dress-up performance I've had.
Now, you've mentioned beer, but we're going to go on from there. So what's your guilty pleasure food?
It is beer, which should be no surprise to anybody.
Bread in a can, yes.
I don't think anybody loves a good pale ale more than I do. And the funny thing, and anybody who knows me knows that, but the funny thing about it is I probably, unless I'm at a meeting, I probably drink beer maybe once a week, and I'll have one or two on a Saturday night. But even my daughter said it recently. She goes, well, Dad, I've never seen you have more than a couple, but I don't think I've seen anybody who loves, absolutely loves, to have that beer too more than I do. So it would be my guilty pleasure.
So what's your favorite all-time beer?
That's a great question. I have a Hall of Fame beer, but none of them are really commercially available. The one that I enjoy the most that's commercially available would probably be, about a three-way tie, but it would be, I love Sam Adams Boston Lager. I love Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, and something you can't get on draft in St. Louis, and I don't know why, but it's Boulevard Pale Ale out of Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've heard of that too.
Those would be my favorites of the real commercially available ones.
What are the ones that aren't commercially available that you remember?
Well, it's funny. I don't have a favorite beer in St. Louis. They had a wonderful one called Zeke's Pale Ale, and the company obviously didn't realize what a customer they had in me, made by a local microbrewery, and they did away with it. So there just isn't one in this area. But I'm very willing to continue performing research to find that beer.
It's out there.
In fact, I'll tell you this too. Every year I do something called Friends of Ed at Opera House in Las Vegas. And one of my hats that I wear, I'm on the Educational Program Committee for the Global Specialty Lens Symposium. And every year we have a big meeting in Las Vegas in the end of January. Well, Friday night every year, I just get a whole bunch of my friends and we go to the Opera House and just have an outstanding time. I won't tell you what some of the things are that we did, but it's phenomenal. And so this Wednesday night, they just opened one up in Belleville. So we're taking our new resident and departing resident, and it just doesn't get any better than the Opera House.
Now, apart from beer, what's something your colleagues don't know about you?
Well, I think a couple of things come to mind. I've always been somebody that has been really fearful of failure. And I think that I've always worried about disappointing people. When I made the transition recently to, for the most part, retire from UMSL, there was an incredible amount of relief when I woke up and knew that I wasn't going to be disappointing students, or I wouldn't have to worry about anything happening to a student or worry about that speech I'm going to give. And it seems like the last 2 months, that's all I was doing. I put a million hours into my last lecture to our third year student, because I love the class. And yes, there were some videos of me dressed up as Benita Henry and our dean, but just the nine innings of contact lenses and going through bifocals and multifocals, illegal contact lenses, all sorts of areas. And then I gave the commencement address to the students, and I wanted that to go well. And then likewise, moderating the white coat ceremony for the second years. And all three of those classes were classes I absolutely loved. And then I work with a baseball player, and he is playing for Tampa Bay. And I was going down there to do a function. And then there was optometry's meeting, and they had a ceremony at our alumni reception that was honoring me. And I knew I'd be giving a speech there. I didn't want to screw that up. I just really was going from one to one to one to one. And I just wanted to do well. And I think that's all these years has been a tremendous motivator for me. But at the same time, I feel better about now maybe transitioning into where I'm not faced with as much and have to worry about as much as I always have.
So you mentioned retirement. So what are your retirement plans?
Well, it's not bad. I'm trying to learn how to play a little bit of golf. And that's a good thing. I do want to put more time in the GP Lens Institute. I work for a journal, and I think that honestly keeps me a little bit busy, as well as the Global Specialty Lens Symposium. And I still feel like there might be something out there, Vernon. I don't know what it is, But there might be something else out there. But I know it feels incredibly good to kind of transition from the 60 to 70 hour weeks. I feel like the last 4 years in particular have been very, very busy. I think I went from 1 year where the CLMA had to deal with a crisis with a drug company that was more or less trying to force them out of business. And then the next year, it was fundraising for our new building. And then the next year, it was being chair of the AOA's contact lens and cornea section. And then this past year, Benita Henry and I were working on another edition of our book. And I just feel like there was always evenings and weekends were just committed to these. And it's nice not to have all those commitments. And so I think that transition's going well.
You mentioned a number of books that you've written. Why not a beer book? Just throwing that out there.
Well, you know, it's funny, Vern. I think I had like 5 residents in a row gave me beer-related presents. So I guess that does tell you something. But no, that would be fun. I mean, I would be glad to do the research for that. That would be a pleasure, but... No, I think, I've been proud of the contact lens books. I will tell you the first one. We wouldn't be having this conversation for the first one. We had an opportunity when I was, when I just first moved here, and I was doing some lectures. It was at our contact lens lab that was, took me, myself and 2 other people, and we gave lectures all around the Midwest. And I was somewhere between awful and terrible, but it was good experience for me. And I came up with the idea that we should have a book on gas permeable lenses. They were in their infancy. People will want to know how to fit them. And I thought it was a good idea. So one of the people I lectured with agreed, Bob Groey, a good friend to this day. So I submitted a proposal to all the publishers and it got rejected by everybody. One of them, I still have the letter. We don't think it's a good topic, and who's ever heard of Ed Bennett? So I was getting desperate. So I called Dr. Borish, and I said, who had written the biggest book in optometry's history, the biggest selling book. And I said, well, Dr. Borish, would you contribute a chapter to my book? He said, sure, Ed. So I put his name on the table of contents. I submitted it to his publisher. And it got accepted. And my life changed dramatically. And the funny thing about that was, several years later, I think Dr. Borish was probably in his 90s, they had a big continuing education event at the IU's College of Optometry, and they only had IU graduates speak. So I was on the program, actually with Dr. Mandel and Dr. Borish. So Dr. Borish lectured, and then I followed him, and he sat down in the front row, and I told that story, which I'm sure he had never heard before. And I told him, he's just beaming. 5 minutes into my lecture, I hear the snoring in the front row, and I put him to sleep. But it is funny. I've had so many lucky breaks that just really the definition of really the mediocre person being able to really find a passion and truly enjoy it and be around a lot of wonderful people. The role models and mentors I've had, certainly starting with Dr. Borish, but I moved to St. Louis and Dr. Rex Gormley was my mentor and a tremendous practitioner, established one of the early contact lens specialty practices. And Professor Alan Tomlinson, who joined the faculty at IU and I was still there, has always been my research mentor. And then even just in the work with the Academy and AOA, I've always been surrounded by really good people. Like when I joined the AOA Council, our incoming chair was Glenda Secor, and I followed Glenda in the Academy leadership. What a great leader and mentor, role model. And then there's Tom Quinn, who's one of my closest friends and one of the great leaders in our profession. Then it was Jeff Wallin. Then it was Jeff Sonsino. Talk about 4 people in a row that are like optometry's Hall of Famers and great leaders and great contributors to the profession. So I've been very fortunate to be around really good role models. And when you do that, good things happen.
What do you see happening to contact lenses in the next 10 years?
Some of it's actually exciting because we're going to wait and see what happens with drug delivery, with areas in terms of accommodative lenses, maybe lenses that help you monitor diabetes. I think those will all be here, some sooner than others. But on the other side of the coin is what's going on with illegal contact lens sales and providing lenses that really fall outside of these companies' legal limits. And for that, that was part of my role when I was AOA contact lens and cornea section chair. But I think we have three really good entities that are helping us, and that's why I think we're going to be okay in the contact lens arena. And those three entities are, we've got a couple of people in the profession called Clark Newman and Jeff Sonsino, who are the brightest names in the profession who are not named Donald Korb. And they are really working hard legislatively. And Clark is the Federal Relations Committee chair for AOA. We have the AOA. Yeah, anybody who's not an AOA member basically is freeloading off the efforts of those who are. The AOA works so hard to advance our profession, but also keep entities from taking away what is legitimately ours, but also the health care of the patient. And we always have to have that foremost. And then I truly think that we just are in a position where we have better lenses coming out that we can provide, sclerals and myopia control lenses, that put us in a position where those are not easy lenses for another entity or third-party entity to be able to provide. So I see a good future for contact lenses.
What's the biggest change in optometry during your career?
Boy, I still think it's medical practice. When I was an optometry student, I was fortunate at Indiana University that they had an attorney general's opinion at that time that we could prescribe therapeutic drugs. The faculty at IU, it's a lot like the faculty at Elsinore right now, the faculty at IU had a lot of graduates from the class of 1976, 3 years ahead of me. They were young, outstanding instructors and very medically oriented. So I got a better education than I think a lot of people did as it pertained to the treatment of eye disease. We've seen that continue, not only being able to treat more, being able to, a few states do lasers, certainly manage glaucoma, but also what we've seen from the standpoint of instrumentation, the ability to monitor the eye and look, certainly it pertains to areas such as glaucoma at its earliest stages, macular degeneration, just the types of equipment that we have today to help us in that area has been wonderful.
How should optometry move forward?
I think in terms of optometry moving forward, we're really in a position of strength right now. We have great grassroots support in every state. We have optometrists who are legislators. We have our state organizations, I think, are very, very strong. Optometry is represented really in essentially every county. So when it comes to eye care, we're the primary entry point for eye examinations. We're the ones that refer to an ophthalmologist or to a primary care physician. So being in that position of strength, I think as the future goes on, and in my position being director of admissions, I've had to tell this to people who are thinking about optometry. Should I consider optometry? What's going to happen in the future? Well, yes, we do have concerns about online eye examinations, online refractions, illegal contact lens sales, and so forth. But I really feel like the AOA and the strength that it represents to the profession, and the fact that we do have all this grassroots support legislatively, will win out and prevail in the years ahead. And I predict a very good future for optometry. It may be different, but somebody has to fit specialty contact lenses. Someone has to provide eye care, and someone has to diagnose and to the limit of their scope of practice, treat eye disease.
Now, if you could go back and change one thing about your career, what would that be?
Oh, boy. I don't have any regrets at all. I had one time in my life that was a little bit challenging because my plan in coming to St. Louis was to go back to IU. You know, I was coming here and following the dean's advice. And I had a couple of opportunities to go back. And the second time would have been a very, very good position. And it was not a good time here at UMSL. I think the decade of the 90s, we had several different deans and interim deans, and it just was not a real happy time in our history. And when I ultimately said no to the position of my dreams, and it was done as a family decision, it just wouldn't have been the right decision for a family. I think for the next year, I kept going, why did I not take that? And then one day you just wake up and you go, listen, you make a decision, and you look forward. And from that moment on, I thought, well, I'm going to just try to help UMSL be the best it can be. And a lot of good things happened after that. We hired IU's dean, didn't get me, but we got IU's dean. He had to retire at 65. We got him to come here, and he really started that change. And he passed away 15 months in office, a gentleman by the name of Jack Bennett. In fact, Jack was just an awesome person. He was probably, I don't know, 20 or so years older than me, but everybody always thought I was related to him. And he was the greatest communicator I've ever seen. So I would love to have been related to him, but he promoted me to be in charge of admissions. And so when I would have an applicant, I'd always take him by the dean's office. And he always looked like he wasn't doing anything. And of course, he was a real shrewd politician. He was already making changes in the school that would have been tremendous. And so I'd introduce him to Jack, and Jack would go, hey, you're from Iowa, huh? Hey, is Mel's Drive-In still on that highway? And the applicant would just be beaming. And then Jack would always say the same thing. He goes, well, I see you've met my older brother, Ed. But when he passed away, when he got ill, he promoted as acting dean, actually a former contact lens resident of mine, Larry Davis. And Larry continued that trend. And for the last 20 years, we've been on an upward trend. And in recent years, we've hired a lot of young faculty. And right now, I can say it's the best faculty we've ever had at UMSL. So it's really been a pleasure. It's a perfect time you always want to leave things when it's better. But all in all, is that a regret? Well, no. You know, everything's been wonderful staying here. So when it's all said and done, I truly don't have any regrets. I've been blessed.
Okay, here's our last question, and we inflict this one on everybody. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
You know, I was trying to think of that, and my wife actually came up with that. When I was growing up, I was like a lot of young people, no fear of heights. I think recently I do. I'll admit it, I do. But I didn't have it growing up. And on a dare, I jumped out of an upper story window of our fraternity house. And I learned what real pain can feel like. And I remember my ankle swelled up, and I was lucky I didn't kill myself. And I had to do a sorority dance that weekend. And of course, they want you to dance. And I was just really suffering. But I think maybe the craziest thing was in high school one summer, every night, three of us climbed all the way up to the top of a water tower in our community and never got caught. But it was I don't know how high that was. But you've seen water towers.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And there'd be a ledge about 10, 15 feet from the top, and we just dangle our legs and sit there every night.
It's like 200 to 300 feet tall, depending on the tower. I mean, and you have to go up those metal cage-like ladder things, right?
Yeah, and the craziest thing was one day we decided we're going to go to the top, all the way up. And the top of water towers is, it's round, but there was a ladder attached to it. So we're climbing, you know, up so we can touch the top of the water tower. And I think back at that today, and one of the three of us almost missed the swinging ladder to get us back to the ledge. And we almost lost him on that. But that would be the craziest thing I'd ever done. I would not recommend that to anybody.
Now, I have to ask, why and what were you thinking? But what was going on?
Just ignorant, young, naive, and dumb, and thinking there's no way anything could happen to me. And I look back at that. I don't think you could pay me enough to do that today. No way.
Well, how old were you at the time?
I would have been around 15, I think.
Yep. That's the time you do those sorts of things.
Yeah, my parents should have kept a closer eye on me.
You were in Indiana. What could possibly go wrong?
I know. I was a Hoosier, where it was a good thing. First moved to Missouri, I think the first evening we went out to dinner, and I could hear people, and they weren't talking about my wife and I, but they were saying, they're nothing but a bunch of darn Hoosiers. That's when we found out Hoosier means hillbilly in Missouri and certain parts of Arkansas.
I did not know that. Well,
you're learning a lot from me, Bernie.
Well, Ed, it's been great talking with you, and we've burned up almost a whole hour. It's been really a lot of fun. Thanks for chatting with me today.
I loved it, Vernon. Thanks for taking the time with me. Take care.
Bye-bye.